second bombing of North Korea was in response to a war started by Kim Il-sung. The terrible destruction caused by the bombing created a cruel reaction. The North Koreans and the Chinese were especially hard on captured American and British airmen, some of whom were tortured, some shot, and some brainwashed and returned to the West with broken minds. The rules of war were pretty much abandoned. Our coach moved on to Kaesong, a weather vane city just north of the DMZ. Before the Korean War, it had been in the south. In 1953, the border was redrawn so the north could have it. It's now home to an industrial zone where northern workers, mainly women, work in factories owned by the south. Kim Jong-un closed the zone, which stands on the northern side of the border, in the spring of 2013, when his nuclear saber-rattling was at its fiercest. By the autumn, talks about reopening the zone were progressing. People in Kaesong looked the most prosperous of all in North Korea. They cannot have been happy that the young leader had cut off their opportunity to make money, but were in no position to protest about it. If there ever is an uprising, Kaesong might be the place where the first spark ignites. After lunch off cripplingly low tables in a fake inn, the bus disgorged us outside an enormous statue to Kim Il-sung, high up on a hill. Here, Kim I is cast in bronze, wearing a Mao jacket underneath an open long-length coat, standing on a white plinth which rests on the summit of a long series of steps. Below them is a preposterously wide road leading downhill away from the statue, so Kim Il-sung dominates the landscape for as far as the eye can see. By this stage in the tour, we were done with bowing, but our minders didn't even suggest it. There was something revolting about this statue, a bronze god demanding adoration, and something revolting, too, about the mindset of the people who require him to be adored. Yet even here there was evidence that the power of the Kim cult might one day turn to dust. 2 million North Koreans now have mobile phones using a heavily circumscribed Egyptian mobile phone system, Orascom. The system is the opposite of 4G. You can't surf the internet because there is no internet, and you can't make a call outside of North Korea because the system blocks all international calls. So the digital revolution that has rocked the world is locked out of North Korea, or is it? The youngest student of all, Dylan, an African-American and quite the coolest and most fashionable of our whole party, and also the sleepiest, powered up his iPhone on the hill by the Kim statue and got a signal from mobile masts in the south just a few miles away. Dylan tweeted, "At the DMZ, #justchillin'. Soon, the whole party were on their phones, texting away. The thing is, if we can do that, so can an enterprising North Korean with a Chinese phone. Working out what is happening on the outside may no longer seem unimaginable, and that spells trouble for the regime. The ice wall blocking out the world of information is beginning to crack, not just for the elite, but for ordinary people too. Gaddafi's Libya, back in the late 1990s, was another state where information about anything was lost in fog. It seemed astonishing that such a bonkers regime had been able to stay in power, by that time for 3 decades. I was also surprised to see so many satellite dishes on people's houses. Clearly, Gaddafi was losing his grip in the information war. It took a long time, but 14 years later, it was the tyrant's turn to face a horrible death. First a grenade blast, then being stabbed in the anus with a bayonet, all of it caught on a mobile phone, news that was no doubt received in Pyongyang with a degree of unease. Chapter 8. Facing the Final Curtain. Kim Il-sung faced the first great threat to his grip on power in 1951 when it was clear that he'd made a terrible mistake in assuming that the South would fold, and the Americans and the West, in general, would let that happen. Even while the Civil War was at its height and American bombs were raining down on North Korea, he cracked down on enemies of the state, real or imagined, and they were sacked, imprisoned, shot, or simply disappeared. 2 years later, the moment the shooting war stopped in the summer of 1953, there was another purge. This time, Pyongyang staged its first major show trial. There were a dozen defendants, the most prominent, Yi Sung-yop, the former secretary of the Central Committee, and one of the very, very few guerrillas who, unlike Kim, had enjoyed a full education. The prosecution charged that an American diplomat called Harold Noble in Seoul told Yi, through a hapless go-between, to create anti-communist insurgents in the north prior to the American invasion at Incheon. At this point, writes Lankoff, any notion of plausibility seems to have deserted the script writers of the show trial. It is too improbable that the Americans would have trusted their agent with such highly classified information. But the script writers had made an even bigger error by attaching a date and a place for Noble's order to Yi's man. Court papers showed that it happened on the 26th of June 1950, when the American was supposedly in Seoul. On that date, Noble was on holiday in Japan. All of the accused spoke their lines well. One defendant kept on repeating, "I am a running dog of American imperialism." When it came to the turn of the defense lawyers, they stated that all the accusations against their clients had been proven. Yi told the court, "Had I two lives, to take them both would have been too little." Yim Hua, a writer who had tried to kill himself, apologized to the court and demanded to be executed. Lankoff summarizes, "The trial, which had started as farce, ended as black comedy. 10 got death sentences, 2 long spells in prison." Why beg the regime for execution if you face certain death? Offstage, out of sight of blind justice, they torture your loved ones in front of you and threaten to torture them some more, or execute them, unless you stay on script. But the regime may have been sensitive to the mocking publicity it got in the international press for the script-writing errors. From then on, it became more fashionable for people just to disappear. Kim did all this when his stock was low and his particular blend of national Stalinism was out of favor. For Stalin's death in March 1953 had cast a cold wind against those leaders of Soviet satellites who were seen to be too dictatorial, too enamored by their own personality cults. In Eastern Europe, the new mood of de-Stalinization saw some leaders toppled from their plinths. In the Kremlin, Nikita Khrushchev ruled the roost. The new breed of Soviets saw Kim Il-sung as yesterday's man. Many Soviet and Chinese archives remain locked up, but the fall of the Berlin Wall has meant that the documents of communist ambassadors from satellite countries are now readily available. Salonti has unearthed a fascinating insight by Soviet counselor A.M. Petrov, reported by Hungarian diplomat Laszlo Keresztes from 1955. "It is a serious error that comrade Kim Il-sung is surrounded by bootlickers and careerists. Whatever is said by the leader, they, other higher-ups in the Korean Workers' Party, accept it without any dispute. Thus, the mistakes are not revealed openly, only in private and belatedly. The personality cult has not changed at all, and it is a primary and decisive factor in every mistake." So, by the time of his 10th anniversary in power, Kim Il-sung's Soviet mentors were bemoaning both the extreme nature of his personality cult and the fact that it was not changing. Salontai's detective work is a great piece of historical research because it challenges an excessively sentimental nostalgia that shrouds our view of the first Kim, indulged by many North Korean defectors and consequently some Western analysts who write with syrupy regard for the great leader. The nostalgists argue that Kim Il-sung was, whatever else you say about him, dedicated to the cause, and that it was his son, Kim Jong-il, who built up the personality cult from the 1970s onwards. At the time the Soviet counselor wrote that memo about Kim Il-sung's personality cult, Kim Jong-il was 9 years old. The Soviet memo signals, too, a fundamental change in the relationship between Moscow and Pyongyang. In 1945, Kim was little more than the Kremlin's puppet on a string. While Stalin was alive, Kim, more or less, did the bidding of the Vorst. From the death of Stalin onwards, Kim Il-sung increasingly became the master of his destiny, and something of a show-off. Enver Hoxha, the one leader of a communist nation possibly even more peculiar and vain than Kim Il-sung, visited Pyongyang in September 1956. The guerrilla leader-turned-dictator littered Albania with concrete pillboxes, wrecked its economy, locked the country up from the outside world, and was, according to the Tirana rumour mill, a closet homosexual who had his lovers murdered after sex. Reporting for The Observer in 1991, after Hoxha was dead but before the Albanian Revolution when they knocked over his statue in Skanderbeg Square, I put the gay sex murder point to President Ramiz Alia, his successor. Alia was Hoxha's lickspittle, a smooth-fleshed non-entity who inherited the tyrant's machine of repression but could not control it. The interview had been extraordinarily boring, and halfway through I decided to follow an observer tradition of being rude to princes, remembering the example of the late Patrick Donovan, who had once interviewed the King of Greece. At the end of the interview, the King asked to inspect Donovan's notebook. On it was only one thing, a doodle of a large black cat. I asked the President the following. Was it true that Hoxha was a homosexual who had the secret police murder his lovers after he had finished with them? Alia had replied, no, he was a family man, and closed the interview. In 1997, I met the deputy prisons director, Bedri Çoku, who had been in the worst prison in Hoxha's gulag, Spash. When I told Bedri this, he shook his head. No, he said, that's wrong. With me in Spash in 1969 was one of Enver's lovers, a man of about 60. He was very discreet about it, but if you were a friend he could trust, he would talk about it. They had sexual relations. Enver did not have him killed because he had saved Enver's life during the war. He sent him to Spash instead. Dictators, they're so fucking weird. Enver wrote up his trip to the DPRK as follows. On September the 7th, 1956, we arrived in Pyongyang. They put on a splendid welcome with people, with gongs, with flowers, and with portraits of Kim Il-sung everywhere. You had to look hard to find some portrait of Lenin, tucked away in some obscure corner. The revisionist wasp had begun to implant its poisonous sting there, too. Later, Hoxha, who had a sharp tongue, was even more dismissive. Kim Il-sung is a pseudo-Marxist, vacillant, megalomaniac, revisionist. Kim Il-sung never quite made it to Albania. The great leader was in a strong position, but that does not mean he was totally secure. Earlier that summer, 1956, Kim had gone to Moscow on his armoured train to discuss Khrushchev's new policy of stepping away from full-throated Stalinism. While the cat was away, the mice plotted. Chechung Ik was his greatest danger, the leader of the Yan'an group, Koreans who had spent time in China and were mentored by the Chinese Communist Party. He and his supporters were alarmed about the personality cult and angered by the forced collectivization of agriculture, the so-called cooperative movement. One complained, "Tax gathering was accompanied by beatings, murders, and arrests. The party's activities are based on violence, not persuasion. The cooperative movement is based on violence." The moment Kim came back, he smelt trouble. Kim felt something was amiss, it was reported, when on his return at Pyongyang Airport, he saw Che turn pale. All his life, Kim Il-sung hated flying and preferred to go by train. It seems on this one occasion he made an exception. Perhaps he was tipped off about the plot and overcame his fear of flying to hurry home before the plotters became too powerful. The conspirators planned to topple Caesar at the party plenum by getting delegates to criticize him openly, but the nerve of the August plotters broke, and their dagger missed its target. Two or three attacking speeches were made, but they fell on deaf ears. Kim Il-sung's secret police were onto them, and very soon the plot crumbled. He was not so strong that he could have Che killed immediately. Instead, the regime's public enemy number one was made the manager of a pig farm. Lan Koff points out that this ploy was a direct steal from Stalin's playbook, humiliating demotion first, then torture, then the firing squad. That's what happened to Bukharin. All we know for certain was that Che was purged and died in 1957, probably not of old age. By the Workers' Party plenum in 1958, Kim Il-sung had wiped out all possible heads of internal opposition. First, communists from South Korea, then Soviet communists, then those who had close links to the Chinese. Left standing at the end of the game were a small handful of guerrillas who had been with Kim in Manchuria and a large mass of slavishly loyal robots who did his bidding. What is remarkable is that Kim managed to play off the Soviet Union and the Chinese against each other, tilting to one side, then the other, but always looking after number one. He played this game deftly, probing Soviet and Chinese Korean clients and friends when the moment was right, exiling some, demoting others, executing opponents when he could get away with it. The vendetta against enemies of Kim was dressed up in the regime's ideology. One old comrade, Yoo Song-chol, had been Kim's interpreter in the Soviet Union and had twice snubbed the guerrilla boss along the lines of, "I'm your interpreter, not your servant." In 1958, he returned from studying in the Soviet Union to Pyongyang, where he was placed in the care of the Thought Examination Committee. It's hard to imagine a more Orwellian title. The attack on his mind was so painful he begged to be killed, but eventually they let him escape back to the Soviet Union in what Martin rightly describes as an outcome at the lower end of the horror curve. From 1958 onwards, Kim Il-sung was safe to repudiate the Soviet Union's new policy of demonizing Stalin as once he had been worshipped. The moment in 1961 when Stalin's waxwork was taken out of its glass box and buried in a grave, albeit in the Kremlin walls, was a breaking point. While Stalin's personality cult became a thing of disgrace across the Soviet Empire, in Pyongyang, the cult of Kim grew like Topsy. As far as the DPRK was concerned, Stalin is dead. Long live the Korean Stalin. Veneration for the leader. The ordinary people of North Korea could go hang. The regime continued to treat its people as if their standard of living, even their ability to stay alive, was a matter of no importance. The Russians in particular were skeptical of Kim's relentless pressure to get on with heavy industry while bleeding agriculture dry. After the end of the Korean War, the economy in the North was all but dead. The leadership sent out their subordinates to bring in more food, in some cases half of a peasant's crop. The regime forbade private grain trade and forced villagers into collective farms. The result was not overnight economic success, but famine. Szalonti uses his Hungarian sources to tell the story of 1955. People on the move from the always undernourished northeast, many starving to death along the way. The victims were not just peasants in the sticks, but also residents of Pyongyang reduced to eating grass. No one knows how many people died in the north in 1955. Nobody counted. But the evidence of famine is real and casts a big shadow on the claims that the north was economically more successful than the south until the late 1970s. People in a thriving economy do not eat grass. Péter Valjé was a Hungarian government delegate who was shocked by the poverty and disease he found in post-war North Korea. The people had no place to live, so they build small wooden huts for themselves. One part of the city is composed entirely of such dwellings. The flats are unhealthy. Tuberculosis is spreading. Another disease is intestinal worms, which is terribly widespread, for there is no animal breeding. Human excrement is practically the only thing they use for manure. To counter the lack of food, the dynasty came up with sillier and sillier solutions. In 1959, Kim Il-sung urged that everybody grow rabbits. In 1999, his son's on-the-spot guidance was for people to breed ostriches. The simplest solution of all, a free market effectively regulated, was not to be considered. As ever is the case with North Korea, the regime survived by getting out the begging bowl. The Chinese and the Soviets injected the country with masses of food aid. Other Soviet satellites like Poland, Czechoslovakia and Romania helped out with doctors and material. By 1957, the famine was over. Szalonti's Hungarian diplomats note the rebuilding of Pyongyang, but even as late as 1977 they warn, "Shops are empty, people are hungry." After our spell by the Kim Il-sung statue sending text messages by piggybacking off the South Korean mobile phone system, we went to the Korea Museum, which has been made a World Heritage Site by UNESCO. He Yong, a man of high culture, found this exhibition of North Korean antiquities no different than the rest of the dodgy nonsense we'd been shown. "Some of the most fake-looking ancient artifacts I've ever seen anywhere in the world." To be fair, it is acknowledged in guidebooks that many of the exhibits are copies, the originals held in another museum in Pyongyang, also open to visitors. That night we ended up in Tadonggang Diplomatic Club Restaurant and Karaoke Bar. As we pored over the menus, the power failed, and I had to mull beef stroganoff versus chicken Kiev by a thin prick of torchlight. It was like camping at the Drones Club. While we ate, some of our party went on a trawl of Westerners who might have gobbets of information. They met one man working for an international NGO who didn't want to talk. He was giving out medical aid, but he did not let on that in 2 years in Pyongyang he had been allowed out of the capital to monitor how his aid was being distributed just 4 times. The karaoke bar was no less dire than any other karaoke bar in the world. Many of the songs were in Chinese, and for the second time that day, Dylan pulled a blinder. Looking at one particularly impossible-to-decipher set of Chinese ideograms, he said, "I know that song," stood up, and rattled it out in what, to my ears, sounded perfect Chinese. As well as studying international relations at the LSE, Dylan had been learning Chinese at school in the States. He sounded pitch-perfect. Having been to the place that may yet end the earth, the theme from Titanic was the only song for me. There is a certain poignancy to my choice which eluded me at the time of karaoke song selection, The date the great ship sank with so many lives lost was the 15th of April 1912, and also Kim Il-sung's birthday. Twin disasters that day, some say. I sang dreadfully. The German and Swiss women plumped for Barbie Girl, perhaps the most Swiftian satire on the emptiness of Western materialism ever written. I did Ken's lines so deep-voiced it hurt my larynx. We looked at Mr. Hyun. He did not let the honour of the People's Republic down. His song of choice? My Way. Mr. Hyun had a powerful baritone. When he stopped, we gave him a standing ovation. Christopher Hitchens noted that Frank Sinatra's My Way was a big hit in the karaoke bar during his trip back in 2000. There's a special plangency to the line about facing the final curtain. Regrets? Forget about that. On the way home on the coach, Miss June had a lullaby for us, the nation's reunification song. And so ended the most surreal day of my entire life. Chapter 9. Cruel Christs of Pus. To the soundtrack of the Beatles' hit song All You Need Is Love, in 1967 the Western world rocked to The Summer of Love. At roughly the same time, a train from Chairman Mao's China was shunted across the Yalu River over the Friendship Bridge into North Korea, carrying ethnic Korean passengers wearing placards around their necks. Look, this will be also your fate, you tiny revisionists. The passengers were long dead. The corpse train spread the contagion of Mao's cultural revolution to North Korea. Kim Il-sung, the father of the half-nation, was denounced by Mao's Red Guards as a fat counter-revolutionary pig. Kim did not challenge his massive neighbour to the north directly. Rather, he created his own version of Mao's murderous paranoia, purging North Korea of all unclean, impure, or foreign elements. The logic was simple. The purer the nation, the safer Kim's grip on power. But the purge didn't just kill current enemies. It looked backwards in time for potential treason, too. In dictatorships like North Korea, history can kill. The old Soviet joke understood the danger from the past. Trouble is, you never know what's going to happen yesterday. The crocodile's tale of yesterday's history becoming today's treason was probably no more lethal than in North Korea at the end of the Summer of Love. That wasn't good news for two lifelong communists who had come to North Korea to help the struggle continue by translating the works of Kim Il-sung. Ali Lameda was a Venezuelan poet living in exile in East Berlin in 1965, when he first made contact with the North Koreans. The notion that beguiled Ali was that North Korea was socialism's shining city on a hill, one of the vanguards of world revolution. He arrived in Pyongyang in the middle of 1966, taking charge of the Spanish section of the Department of Foreign Publications. There he met the grand old man himself, Kim Il-sung, and also Park Hun-chul, a senior government minister. Ali translated Kim's works and regime propaganda, already in English, into Spanish. His colleague was Jacques Cedillo, a Frenchman, also known as Manuel Cedillo, more than 60 years old, who had fought for the left in Spain and Algeria. He translated the regime's English into French. Ali described him, "a magnificent man, truly internationalist, honest and courageous." The two became firm friends. The Venezuelan was treated handsomely, boasting a special apartment at the Pyongyang International Hotel and a car and driver. His German girlfriend, Elvira Tanzer, came with him to Pyongyang. "I went because I was so in love with him," she later said. But the curious anomie of North Korea set in like dismal drizzle. Ali noted that his driver was changed weekly, so he could never establish a friendly relationship with any of them. Ali explained, We felt stifled, an overwhelming feeling of isolation. However much my sympathy lay with the great work of national construction of the Korean people, I could never communicate. Ali wrote to his friends and family abroad, sharing his sense of frustration at this enforced isolation. Innocently expecting his private correspondence to remain private, he condemned North Korea's abject poverty and suggested that this was not the communism he had dreamed of. The work was deeply frustrating. Ali and Jacques set about translating the regime's fairy tale, but the fables of Kim Il-sung, the child prodigy, were blackly farcical. Things came to a head when Jacques was dispatched to France to recruit more translators. Instead of carrying out his instructions to the letter, Jacques, who had after all been a colonel in the Republican Army against Franco's fascists, undertook an opinion poll, asking around 250 people what they thought of North Korean propaganda. Ali summarized Jacques' report, "Propaganda which says that, at 14, Kim Il-sung was the leader of the Communist Party, had launched a revolution and directed an army, a child leading a Communist Party revolution in a country without a Communist Party, beating the Japanese army and so on, it seems very hard to believe." Jacques' report also touched on Kim Il-sung directly, reflecting an opinion from a French source who made an unflattering comparison between the modesty of the Nicaraguan revolutionary hero Augusto César Sandino and the great leader. Ali's reaction was sensible. "When he showed it to me, I told him what a good report it was, a first-class piece of work, but as regards Kim Il-sung, he should, I suggested, obliterate that." The Frenchman stuck to his guns, arguing that the Koreans should change their propaganda. Michael Harold, a somewhat eccentric British sub-editor who spent 7 years in Pyongyang from 1987, bemoaned the absurd quality of the propaganda he had to deal with. "I got one across my desk today. The Yankee soldiers took out their bayonets and sliced through the women's breasts like bean curd." The precise trigger for the disaster that befell Ali and Jacques is not quite clear. Isidore Urian, Ceausescu's translator, told me that he had met Ali. The former Romanian diplomat explained that on a tour of the Museum of Korean History, Ali had walked past statues of past Korean emperors, about which his guides said absolutely nothing. When they came to a statue of Kim Il-sung, Ali asked, "And which emperor is this?" "This," said Isidore, "was the starting point of his tragedy." Ali wrote that in September 1967, the two translators went to a banquet thrown for employees of the Department of Foreign Publications. Ali made veiled jokes, tilting at Kim Il-sung. Jacques, a quieter man, was probably more discreet, but the Koreans knew about his report, questioning the vanity and absurdity of the propaganda. 3 days later, there was a knock at Ali's door. Two police officers and 7 plainclothes men from public security, the Bowie Boo, told Ali that he was an enemy of the Korean people. No formal charges were mentioned, and led him away. His girlfriend, Elvira, was left alone, forbidden to leave the city. That same night, Jacques was also arrested. He was accused of being a French imperialist spy, the blackest possible insult for a lifelong communist and veteran of the civil wars in Spain and Algeria. Ali wrote of the charge against his friend, "It was grotesque for it to be said that he was a spy, an agent of French imperialism." Later, their boss, the Korean director of the translation department, was also picked up. Ali found himself in a damp, cold cell, 7 feet long by 3 wide, in the Interior Ministry prison, and the long, endless nightmare began. He was interrogated for 12 hours at a stretch, the formula remaining the same. "Confess," they said. "Confess what?" You know what there is to confess. Talk. But if it is you who are accusing me, you tell me. The sounds of the prison were bleak beyond the saying of it. People coughing up blood, random howls, screams. You can soon learn to distinguish whether a man is crying from fear or pain or from madness. He was not routinely tortured like the others. On one occasion, a guard, furious that he had not showed sufficient deference, gave him a beating, kicking him with his boots and hitting him on the soles of his bare feet. To persuade him to confess, they used hunger as a weapon. "Better to be beaten," Ali wrote, "as it is possible to grind one's teeth and withstand physical pain. To be continuously starving is worse." When they did feed him, the meal was a hunk of dirty bread weighing about 250 grams and a bowl of water with a few chunks of vegetable in it. The metal dishes the food was served on were always filthy, the same ones the prisoners had been using for years, never washed. No change of clothes. To his knowledge, the only medicines used to treat prisoners were terramycin, an antibacterial drug, and cooking oil. Young prison guards newly assigned to the camp often expressed their amazement at such conditions, wrote Ali. "I was not tortured, if by this one means the systematic infliction of pain, but if terrible hunger and continual nastiness come under this definition, then I was." When Ali was released 1 year later, he had lost 22 kilos, 50 pounds, or more than 4 stone. He was covered in sores, seeping blood. After 2 months under house arrest, they told him that he would be free to leave the country, but that Elvira had to go first. He was allowed to see her off at the airport and returned to pack his bags. They were playing with him. At 5 o'clock in the evening, the police returned, more brutal than before. He asked why they were arresting him for a second time. "You know why," they told him. Ali concluded they had installed a microphone in their apartment and had recorded his conversation with Elvira. "What did they expect me to say to her when I returned from a year's detention in such a bad physical condition?" His literary work had been confiscated on the orders of the Party Central Committee. It was described as bourgeois filth. His second arrest, Ali wrote, "after believing I was at last to be released, was one of the worst moments I was forced to endure." Then came his trial. It was a joke, but not a funny one. He asked for a lawyer of his choice, and that the tribunal should be held in the open, but such demands were dismissed as bourgeois. Ali was provided with a so-called defense counsel. The only people present apart from the judges were 2 uniformed policemen and a young interpreter. The trial lasted for 1 day, from 9 o'clock in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. He was suffering from fever and was given nothing to eat all day. Like his interrogators, the judges demanded that he confess his guilt. The tribunal did not make any specific accusations. There were no formal charges, but the accused had to accuse himself before the tribunal. "Thus," wrote Ali, "there was no necessity for the tribunal to produce any evidence. I had no right to defend myself. I could only admit guilt." Ali did not oblige, but insisted that he had committed no crimes, that he had only come to Korea as a servant of the government. When he tried to ask questions, he was abruptly interrupted and told that he had no right to defend himself. The prosecutor informed him that he had been in Korea to sabotage, spy, and introduce infiltrators, that he was working for the CIA. Ali said that was absurd. The prosecutor read from the penal code, which emphasized the gravity of his crime, and demanded the maximum penalty for the crimes he had committed: death. Ali's defense counsel chipped in, making a lengthy eulogy to Kim Il-sung, and asked for 20 years for his client. The tribunal retired for 5 minutes and came back, granting Ali's defense brief his wish, 2 decades with forced labor. Ali was handcuffed to the bars of a Black Maria for 3 hours. The temperature outside was way below freezing. Opposite him in the van, sitting on a seat, was a guard who spent the journey loading and unloading his gun. Outside, the howling of wolves. The mountain country of North Korea in winter is beyond cold. Temperatures regularly drop below minus 20 degrees Celsius. Ali was dumped in a filthy cell where he slept on the bare floor with no blanket or mattress. He stayed there, constantly handcuffed, fearing his wrists would break with the strain. After 3 weeks, he was taken to the main camp around 10 o'clock at night and placed in a cell which had no heating apart from for 5 minutes at night when a pipe burbled with hot water. The windows were iced up. His feet froze and stayed frozen for 6 weeks. His toes became hideously swollen, all his toenails fell out, and he could only hobble because of the sores and ulcers on his feet. His main source of information was the prison screws, who let drop that he had been put in a punishment cell, which should not really have happened, but since he was a foreigner, and it was the first time a foreigner had ever been held at the camp, there was no isolation cell in which to hold him. As a foreigner, he was not to be allowed to come into contact with the other prisoners. The prison regime was always the same. The prisoner must sit cross-legged, perfectly still, for 16 hours from 6 o'clock in the morning until 10 at night. He must be rock steady, immobile, looking straight ahead towards the bars of his cell. The bars were iron rods that ran from ceiling down to the floor. Between the cells was a corridor along which the guards patrolled. The prisoners had to stay awake all day. The official explanation was that a prisoner should be constantly examining his conscience. A prisoner must not stretch his legs. If he did so, he was beaten. Ali found this last rule unbearable. He lost all feeling in his left leg, and he feared that he would end up paralyzed. The cold, the filth, the hunger and the loneliness were beyond words. Barefoot, afflicted by lice, diarrhea, and fevers, knowing nothing of what was happening outside the bars that imprisoned him, Ali found himself living a Kafka story. To survive, he wrote poetry inside his head and recalled Oscar Wilde's The Ballad of Reading Gaol. "I never saw sad men who looked with such a wistful eye upon that little tent of blue we prisoners called the sky." Worst of all, Ali feared that no one in the outside world had any idea where he was. It was a 1960s version of the oubliette, the medieval torture by which prisoners were dropped into a hole and forgotten. Once he came across a French prisoner, a man who said that he was a French journalist who lived at 2 Rue d'Alembert, Paris, that his name was Pierre. But the stranger had spoken too much, and the guard smashed his rifle butt into him, so the surname remains unknown. In Paris, I knocked on the door of the building. No one knew of a Pierre who vanished 40 years ago. From chatting to the screws and snatched conversations with other prisoners, Ali started to work out how many camps there were. He concluded that the gulag contained some 150,000 souls spread around some 20 camps. Ali is long dead, but I managed to track down his nephew, Carlos David, an artist who lives in Paris. Sitting in his tiny flat in Alfortville, decorated with a 1973 poster in Spanish, "Free the Poet, Ali Lameda," Carlos told me how word somehow got back to Venezuela that Ali was locked up in North Korea. Elvira is the most likely source, but I have so far failed to trace her. Carlos's father, Carlos Diaz Sosa, Ali's brother-in-law, was a Venezuelan journalist turned diplomat. He used his contacts in communist embassies to put the word out. For years they heard nothing. Every entreaty was met with no response. They had no idea whether Ali was still alive. Then, in 1973, North Korea started the long road towards becoming a member of the United Nations, and its foreign minister, looking around for votes, asked the Venezuelan legation in New York for their vote. The Venezuelans asked, "What about Ali Lameda?" The foreign minister asked, "Is that a rock on the railway track?" The Venezuelans nodded. The foreign minister said he had no idea of the case but would report back. Eventually, word came back from Pyongyang that Ali Lameda was alive, and then pressure from Caracas grew. Carlos Diaz Sosa asked the Cubans to intercede, but it seems Castro did not lift a finger, thanks to a doctrinal dispute between the Cuban and Venezuelan communist parties. Every time the Venezuelans threw a diplomatic reception and heard that the North Koreans would be attending, in capitals like Warsaw and Prague, Carlos Diaz Sosa flew in from London, where he was based, and presented the North Koreans with letters for Kim Il-sung and the imprisoned poet. The Romanians, the North Koreans' closest allies in the Soviet bloc, brokered the deal. 7 years after his first arrest, on the 27th of September 1974, Ali was allowed to leave North Korea. On arrival in Bucharest, the poet had to sign a letter swearing that the dire state of his health and the torture scars on his body were the result of captivity in a Venezuelan prison. The regime was trying to cover its tracks. Ali was in a terrible state. Thin, half mad, he had a tumor on his back and paralysis in his left leg that resulted from being forced to squat cross-legged for years. But the regime fattened him up before releasing him. In Berlin, Ali underwent surgery on the tumor and the frozen nerves in his leg. In late December 1974, he ended up in London, where his Venezuelan family were living in Finchley. Carlos David, then 14, had to give up his bed for his uncle. The grown-ups stayed up all night for 3 nights talking. It was as if my uncle had come back from the dead, which, in a way, he had. His poem, Pietà, recalled from memory because to write it down would have been the death of him, told the truth. Life in the abstract, in its great coach, how nice. But amidst vomit and outrage, the real thing triumphs. It flows, sewage and decay. I suffer moons, hungers, cruel Christs of pus. I give in bone the explanation of this, my misfortune. Ali died on the 30th of November 1995. His friend Jacques Sédillot never made it out of North Korea, dying sometime in 1976. Ali's report for Amnesty in 1979 is a line in the sand, the first account by a Westerner and a communist to boot, of the true nature of the regime. From that year on, no one could have any doubt that the North Korea gulag was a serious contender to be the worst place on earth, that Kim Il-sung's regime had nothing whatsoever to do with advancing the brotherhood of man, and that it used hunger as a weapon to ensure that its people obeyed. Alejandro Cao de Benos of the Korean Friendship Association dismisses criticism of the North Korea gulag. "These are re-education camps. With 23 million people, sometimes you may have a few criminals. We believe not in punishment, but in rehabilitation. It's a kind of psychological therapy." After reading Ali Lameda's report for Amnesty and his poem, that is a sentence I would never utter. Chapter 10. Pissing on Marble. In December 1969, two Italian communists set off to Pyongyang on the first ever delegation of the PCI, the Italian Communist Party, to North Korea. The two men were both heroes of the Italian left, Emanuele Macaluso is a Sicilian leftist senator who has spent his life challenging the morbid power of the mafia in his home island and throughout Italy. His friend, Antonello Trombadore, was then a famous artist who, during the Second World War, had been locked up by Mussolini and then the Nazis before escaping. If communism ever had a human face, Macaluso and Trombadore were it. The artist died in 1993, but Macaluso is still with us. A brilliant little gnome of a man, 89, whose impassive shrugs suggest a pint-sized version of Marlon Brando's Godfather. Their trip to North Korea took place at the height of the rift between the Soviet Union and China. That spring, the Chinese People's Liberation Army had attacked a Soviet position on a disputed island in a river of the far west of China, leaving 59 dead, including a senior colonel. The Chinese also managed to capture a then-secret T-62 tank. Both sides had tested nuclear bombs, and the communist world stood on the brink of a terrible internecine war. The shooting died down, but the ideological conflict continued. As the two great communist powers clashed, smaller communist parties tried to reach out to one another to find common ground. Both the Italian and the North Korean parties were keen to show the Soviet Union and China that they could entertain independent relations between friendly socialist parties without the interference of either Big Brother. Logistically, however, they were stumped. The Italians had to fly to North Korea via Moscow, and the Russians were not keen on the PCI doing its own thing. So for 3 days they lay stranded at Moscow airport, the excuse being the weather. On the fourth day, the North Koreans, who had been growing increasingly impatient, made Kim Il-sung's very own jet available to the Italians. As they embarked, Trombadore could not help but notice the similarities with the Pope's personal plane, which he had recently travelled on as a journalist: comfortable large beds, elegant rooms for conversation, and excellent food. The Catholic Church and the North Koreans had different ideologies, but, as it turned out, the same taste in executive air travel. The North Koreans held the Italians in high esteem. At the very least, the visit of the PCI delegation to Pyongyang meant that Kim Il-sung could claim to have friendly relations with the largest communist party in Western Europe. Both Macaluso and Trombadore were thus received almost as if they were heads of state. Despite their familiarity with Soviet satellites, they soon realized that North Korea was a world unto itself. Macaluso had walked around Krakow, visiting the churches. In Budapest, he'd enjoyed some of the admittedly meagre nightlife. None of this was possible in Pyongyang. The Italians were escorted everywhere by an official of the Korean Workers' Party. When they were taken shopping in one of the main squares of the city, they were amazed to see that everyone else had already been made to leave. No soldiers, no workers, no civilians walked across the square. The PCI delegation was shown the house where Kim Il-sung was born, the cradle where he'd slept, and the desk where he'd studied. Macaluso, a Sicilian, no stranger to religiosity, said, "They showed us a shrine containing pool cues that had been used by the great leader as if they were a saint's relics, all whilst he was still alive." The visiting Italians found the food ghastly. Macaluso recalled how even the most privileged North Koreans still kept all their vegetables and other food in brine because of the lack of fridges. He didn't comment on this habit, just pulled a very miserable face. Kim Il-sung, to the two Italians, was no saint. He was far more approachable than the cult of personality would have suggested, smart and sly, and also, it seemed, more than a little paranoid. He told them about the attempts on his life that had been organized by Khrushchev. To the Soviets, Kim implied, for the North Korean leader to exercise independent relations with China was to be guilty of treachery. Macaluso pointed out the contradiction between North Korea's claim to political independence and its support for the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, crushing the Prague Spring in 1968. After the translator had spoken Macaluso's words, Kim Il-sung remained silent. The other officials in the room looked in disbelief at the Italian communist. Several months later, Macaluso received a publication in French from the North Koreans, which amended their position on the Prague Spring and the Czech demands for socialism with a human face, signalling opposition to Soviet force majeure. The relationship between the Italians and the North Koreans, however, was not without tension. In Italy, the PCI had to compete at free elections with other parties who took human liberty as standard. The PCI delegation tried to discuss cultural and personal freedoms with the North Koreans, with very little success. The East Germans would listen to the Italians talk about liberty and counterattack, pouring acid scorn on the PCI's ideas. The North Koreans simply ignored them. Macaluso said their attempt to get Pyongyang to engage on political freedom was like pissing on marble. Buzo analyzes the marmoreal nature of the regime in his book The Guerrilla Dynasty. A particular facet of Kim's personality which compounded the stultifying effect of ideology was his pervasive mistrust. The purges, the elaborate multiple overlapping security agencies, the continuing high level of repression, Kim clearly perceived the threat to his system posed by interaction with even other socialist countries. No wonder the Italians found getting across their far more human version of communism to their host hard work. Buzo asks why North Korea declined in economic backwardness in the 1970s. The major part of the answer lies simply in the extent to which Kim Il-sung lost touch with reality. Physical isolation, paranoia, an overbearing, browbeating personal manner, the corrupting effects of power without accountability, the cumulative effect over decades of daily exposure to extravagant flattery, growing megalomania, all combined to give Kim the illusion of control over events and deprive him of any real capacity for self-reflection and self-correction. Kim Il-sung had become a delusional illusionist. Chapter 11. Would the dear leader not be offended by such a gift? The Kim Jong-il Museum of Gifts is housed in a fancy palace in the countryside, about half an hour or so outside of the big zombie. Outside the entrance doors, which would have let in a troop of Indian elephants, stood what felt like half the Korean People's Army, but the crowd was only around 5,000 strong. They were in town for the big parade the following day, a parade we only got to hear about after the fact. Still, the massed ranks of Korean squaddies helped conjure up the awe and veneration constantly urged on us by our minders for the leaders, Doris Day and Midget's Turd. Thing is, by day five, we were becoming inured to their blandishments. Worse than that, some of our party were up for devilry. The Kim Jong-il Museum of Gifts can be easily confused with the International Friendship Exhibition, which is a bigger effort, mostly dedicated to gifts to Kim I, housed in a colossal pagoda in the mountains, 3 hours' drive from Pyongyang. Both museums are the Kim dynasty's version of an attic where you bung all those useless gifts various aunts have given you over the years, or the drinks cupboard where you dump the sticky yellow booze you quite liked on holiday but tastes horrid back home in Blighty. The idea of venerating that kind of junk is frankly absurd. This being the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, we were asked to do exactly that. First, we had to put white nylon over socks around our shoes, lest we muddy the marble. Then we had to dump our bags and stuff, especially cameras, in a large cloakroom. I was excited by this tour because I collect tyrant kitsch. At home, up in our attic, we have a moth-eaten Saddam Hussein carpet. I put it up there after they hanged him. At the bottom of a pile of books at my desk is a copy of Omagiu, Homage, which I borrowed from the Romanian Communist Party Central Committee building on Christmas Day 1989. In the Frontline Club, inside a glass case, is Odeh Hussein's snorkel mask, which fell into my hands. When it was my turn to dump my stuff at the cloakroom, I somehow forgot to hand over my BlackBerry, complete with NAF-quality camera phone. A few moments later, Mr. Hyun kindly invited a Korean security woman with a handheld metal scanner, playing the role of Franz Beckenbauer in the 1972 World Cup, to give me the sweepover. Beep, beep went her machine, and Mr. Hyun escorted me back to the cloakroom to hand over my phone. I felt like a naughty boy. They wiped us all clean, but somehow Erica managed to smuggle her iPhone in. We hadn't asked her to, but she had managed to get her iPhone in. Our tour commenced with the obligatory local guide, a gimlet-eyed lady with a frozen moo on her mush. First off, there was Kim Il-sung, sitting on a big marble throne, ready and willing to accept posthumous presents. And then we started processing through engine sheds of junk, tat from all four corners of the globe. There were vases, NAF oil paintings, military paraphernalia and whatnotery. On and on it went. Without cameras, it was hard to recall it all, and one is left a bit like a contestant on Bruce Forsyth's Generation Game, having to remember the objects briefly revealed on the conveyor belt, a cuddly toy, a fondue set, roller skates. Standout nonsense included a mug advertising the ABBA musical Mamma Mia, a Mamma Mia badge, and a Twin Towers fridge magnet. As Kenny Everett's transvestite character Cupid Stunt used to exclaim, "It's all in the best possible taste." We started to titter. Our local guide became more and more cross. The Hitch visited the bigger museum in the mountains. He too had found it hard to keep a straight face, confronted with a bear's head from Ceausescu, a chess set from Gaddafi, a crocodile skin suitcase from Castro, an old gramophone from Zhou Enlai, an armored train from Chairman Mao, and a VHS copy of Space Jam, donor